With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Real Spoilers, powered by ReviewSTL.com.
Warning, the following film discussion will ruin the ending of any movie you haven't seen. Example, Bruce Willis is dead at the end of The Sixth Sense. See how I ruined it for you? Just like that. Here are a few more.
Silent breed is people!
I am the father.
Get it?
Real Spoilers. You've been warned.
Broadcasting from the lush but not lavish studios located in the basement of the O'Keefe Institute for Advanced Film Snarkitude, and my timer worked this time.
Hey-o!
It's Real Spoilers, episode 497, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Oh, man. I'm so excited.
Are you?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think I'm going to be the odd man out.
Oh, no.
I can honestly say this is the best movie I've ever seen that I didn't like.
Interesting.
Yeah.
That should be the tagline for the movie.
Yeah, I'm sure that's what they would put on the poster.
Yeah, I don't think so.
Here's what somebody you've never heard of has to say poorly about
the movie. No, but what they would do is what they do with all clip pulls. They would take off the last few words.
Right.
The best movie I've ever seen.
Right.
Dot, dot, dot. Yeah.
They don't even put the dots in anymore.
That's a small price to pay to end up with my
on
name
the Tarantino
on a Tarantino poster.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because I love Tarantino, but this movie just did not do it for me. So I guess before we dig in, let's go around the table and everyone can introduce themselves.
This is Paul.
This is Joe.
This is Kevin.
And this is Tom. I'm just letting Paul I'm not even treating him as
a guest. He's a green jacket club.
He's been on here enough.
Yeah.
So before we dig in, real quick, shameless plugs. Don't forget, we're available on Apple Podcasts, where you can go rate, review, subscribe. Check us out on Facebook at facebook.com/realspoilers. While you're there, you can also join the group so you can have chats about films and tell me why I'm an idiot for not liking this. And you can also check us out on Patreon, because after hearing how much I hate this, you'll want to give us money so they can move this to a different location. And that's patreon.com/realspoilers. So there, all of that is out of the way. Let's tackle Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
So this movie ticks all my boxes. Like, it's 60s Hollywood, which I love.
Yeah, it looks great.
It's the Manson family, which is an amazing story. Yeah. And not in a good way, but I mean, it's just like...
It's a fascinating story.
Absolutely.
If he had told it.
Okay.
But the movie isn't about that.
It's not.
That's why he...
But, and I didn't realize what he was doing until the end. And I was like, oh, it's a fairy tale.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
absolutely a fairy
and
tale.
And I had a feeling that's where we were heading about a third of the way into the movie.
Oh, really?
And I was just like, I don't think... I'm like, he's just not giving us enough Manson for this to be the Manson story.
Which is...
And like I think obviously this guy didn't really live next door because he's not a real person.
Right.
And so I'm just like these stories, it's not... Like, how do the narratives intertwine in a way that would be satisfying if it's just, oh, and then the last scene, this awful thing happened next door, thank you, good night.
Like, so, but if you went in thinking it was going to be that, then that's your fault. You shouldn't have made that presumption that that's what Tarantino was doing. Oh, it's a movie about Charles Manson.
Well, I didn't think it was a movie about Charles Manson, but I also didn't think it was a movie that was going to completely erase what happened.
But that, I think that's the brilliance of it.
But I also feel like I've seen this. you've done this before.
And it wor-
Inglorious Bastards.
Oh, but not in the same, but in
he killed
still,
Hitler.
But he's still, but he's still.
And he killed Hitler in the same effing way.
But
they smashed his face in.
Yeah.
But like, that, we've seen this.
But that's the thing, though. See, in that one, he just had Hitler die a different way. But in the end, Hitler dies. This completely rewrites history.
No, that completely rewrote history because we know Hitler's dead. You soldiers killed Hitler. It will be a known thing. They will be heroes. It was the heroic action of
the U.S. military.
The Allied powers finally killing Hitler
rather than him dying in like a shelter.
Rather than him maybe dying somewhere. You know,
right?
I mean, I think only conspiracy theorists think
he's still alive.
Think he didn't die, but still, you didn't have that. The satisfaction of the good guys killing Hitler. So I feel like that was a complete rewrite.
I can see that.
And I just felt like, and I enjoyed it in that setting.
Sure.
Because
I can't believe you just nodded to conspiracy theorists who might believe that Adolf Hitler didn't die in the bunker.
Yeah.
Just like Jesus. Jesus didn't.
Like, that's like two guys.
But we should.
I think if there's anything the current history has taught us when it comes to conspiracy theorists, it's sadly more than two guys.
If we had Twitter in 1945, this would be the number one trending topic.
It would. It absolutely would.
Yeah. But we should say that this is a movie that deserves the spoiler warning. So
yeah, that's,
as you know, we spoil these movies, but this one, especially the ending, hinges on you not knowing the spoilerificness of it.
It's also, yes, so this, be prepared. If you know the Manson case, you know what happened.
But I think the thing is that I don't think you should even go into this movie knowing there's a twist or a spoiler. See, because even knowing that, then you look for it.
Right.
Like, I know this is a little late, but go watch this movie before you even think about listening to any of this.
Yeah, I agree.
That you can going forward, because
I think Tarantino's enough of a brand at this point where I don't think very many people would listen to this before seeing the movie.
Totally. Yeah. But just for the, like,
if Hobbs and Shaw had done this.
But some people aren't Tarantino people.
Right.
And so, like,
well, then they're wrong.
Okay.
Well, but if you're not a Tarantino guy, I don't think this movie's going to be your thing.
No.
This movie is not. I mean, one, it's quintessential Tarantino, and in my opinion, it's substandard quintessential Tarantino. And I think that this is not the movie that's going to make somebody a Tarantino fan. If you're not already on board, this movie ain't going to do it for you.
But if you don't like Tarantino stuff, this isn't the Tarantino brand of that you come to expect, so I would argue that this would be one you'd enjoy.
I think this is exactly the Tarantino brand.
I think this is on brand.
I mean, most
tough macho guys, pop culture rammed down your throat, cool soundtrack.
This is Jackie Brown.
I don't know. I think this is one of the least quote unquote Tarantino movies he's ever made.
Whoa,
there's not as much vulgarity. There's not as much of the hyper violence. It's a very slow moving, character development
from a pacing standpoint. But I would agree. But other than that, it's all the
it's
Tarantino
all there,
elements
yeah.
are there.
If you were to show me this after, if I did not know who directed this, and you said, hey, just watch this movie, go in blind, I would absolutely know that this is a Tarantino movie. Okay. I mean, is it on the violence level of Kill Bill or Django? No, but
stylistically,
it looks exactly the same. And in that's interesting because it is a different editor. Like, his editor passed away after it was Hateful Eight.
The first one with the new editor was Django.
Okay. And so, but like, his movies since Django have all looked the same. The movie opens up.
And
with,
I think this movie really misses that editor.
I would have taken another hour of this movie easily.
I would have taken another hour of this movie when they weren't driving their goddamn car.
I loved it.
It was 40 minutes of them driving the effing car.
Is it
Brown Bunny? What the?
Usually I agree with you about driving cars. I can't stand when we have to have a minute and a half of a character, usually in California with their arms on the side of their convertible, driving wherever it is. However, this was so beautifully designed that when he's driving down Sunset Boulevard and you see the storefronts and the restaurants, and especially the movie marquees,
right.
He would drive past. It's like, I don't remember the night they raided Minsky's came out in 1969.
I mean,
one right after the other.
Yeah. It was beautiful.
It established the era.
It established it and established it and established it, and then it established it some more.
I couldn't get enough.
I agree.
So, I think if they had been driving and there wasn't something going on inside the car, I would agree with you.
But there was so much of just driving.
You get the scene with him and the girl in the car, which I thought was an amazing...
yeah, like, that's fine.
I don't mind DiCaprio in the car.
I don't mind that a scene with dialogue takes place in the car.
Yeah.
But there was large chunks of the movie where it was literally just them driving around listening to the radio.
That's in Kill Bill.
But
he does that in Kill Bill, too, though.
But you're seeing 1969 Hollywood. This is the era that Tarantino grew up in, this is his love letter to 60s Hollywood.
Okay.
And so it's just, I think by seeing it all, I mean, we don't get to see this all the time, though. Like, we're taken back to an era.
It looked great. I just think there's other ways to convey it than just 30-minute establishing shots.
How did you feel about her walking down the street? Like, was it on the same level as him driving?
Yeah,
like when you see Margot Robbie kind of walking down the street, like through storefronts and theaters and stuff like that. Like, do you think that was on the same level?
I guess because they didn't keep going back to it, it didn't irritate me in quite the same way. But there was a lot of driving.
That's true.
A lot of driving.
And let me also add, if you're bored at any point by Margot Robbie doing anything,
don't go to movie theaters. This movie's not for you. But I think they expanded her part. They gave her, I think that they went back and gave her more to do because there wasn't a lot for her to do.
I don't think so.
But see, this is where I get frustrated when I hear that there's like an entire subplot or at least scenes with like a young Burt Reynolds, and I'm like, and I don't get that so that you can drive around.
Oh, see, I thought that Rick Dalton was based off Burt Reynolds.
Yeah.
I think it's both, but they supposedly filmed something with an actor playing Burt Reynolds.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And so, because this would have been Burt Reynolds is working in television, trying to break into movies in this time frame. So he's not, he was on a TV show, a Western,
right,
trying to become a movie actor. So he was kind of like the young version of what Rick Dalton's doing.
And the relationship between Rick Dalton and Cliff, the Brad Pitt character in this, is totally based on Burt Reynolds and Hal Needham.
And Hal Needham, yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. It's supposed to be an amalgamation of Hal Needham and some other stuntmen, but that is one of them. I don't think that they were supposed to have Burt Reynolds in this because Burt Reynolds was supposed to play the Bruce Dern character before he died, so I don't think they would have had Burt Reynolds in a movie with Burt Reynolds. I think that's
Are you saying there was supposed to be an actor like, who's the guy from Homeland?
That's what he's saying, yeah.
Is that there was supposed to be somebody else
Damon
playing
Damon Lewis or whatever.
And I got to tell you,
he looks just like Steve McQueen.
There was a creepy moment when he's sitting, like, you don't see him from you see him kind of in the shadows. His hair's kind of long. I am shocked at how much he looked like Steve,
unbelievable.
Steve McQueen.
All the casting in this movie.
And spoke like and acted like.
Yeah.
I've never seen a Steve McQueen impression in my entire life. This one, I was stunned that it wasn't actually Steve McQueen. I said, how did they do that?
Yeah.
That's the best deep fake I've ever seen.
Yeah. But Burt Reynolds was cast, like literally was cast and agreed to do this movie as George Spahn.
Okay.
And then he passed away and was recast with Bruce Dern. So I think maybe
he cast James Marsden to play Burt Reynolds.
Oh, I can absolutely see that.
And it was filmed and they cut it?
It's the headline from Vanity Fair: Quentin Tarantino tapped James Marsden to play Burt Reynolds in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Well,
but Marsden doesn't appear in the final film. What happened? Yeah. So,
don't worry. That 4-hour Netflix cut.
I wonder if maybe because Burt Reynolds passed away, maybe he. I don't know why you would do that. That's interesting. I never even heard that casting.
Yeah. Here's another interesting thing: in the final credits,
there's a lot of names.
There's a credit for Tim Roth, and next to his name it says "cut." Mm-hmm. I don't remember seeing that for James Marsden. And I'd never seen any actor get that credit on screen.
Yeah.
You don't appear in the movie. Like when you saw The Big Chill, there was no Kevin Costner. Cut.
Right.
That's true.
That was, I mean, yeah. Apparently, that's one of the things that if they do the extended version, like that was filmed, actually.
Yeah.
I'm guessing the Reynolds stuff didn't get filmed, but the Tim Roth stuff was filmed, and so he had to cut it for this release because it was just already 3 hours. But if there's a 4-hour cut out there, I'm sure that's in there. And there was some more Margot Robbie in a pool or something. I just read some articles about what he talked about he had to cut. And so there was supposed to be some more of her doing something toward the end of the movie. But
according to this, sounds like it was filmed. It just was cut.
Hmm. Oh.
Maybe Tim Roth is in the Burt Reynolds
thing. Maybe.
Yeah, that's interesting. Okay.
So, yeah. So this movie opens up with basically just an old-timey NBC ad with DiCaprio and Brad Pitt. And they kind of talking about Bounty Law, which is this Western that they're on.
Rick Dalton is the star,
Rick
played
Dalton
by DiCaprio.
And Cliff Booth is Brad Pitt.
From 1959.
And I got to tell you, Brad Pitt almost steals this movie away from DiCaprio.
I think he does.
As great as DiCaprio is, Brad Pitt, it's just like, oh yeah, that's Brad Pitt.
It's close. They're almost co-leads. Man, I mean, you know what I mean? Like,
he
not
is great.
Lead and supporting. Like, it's.
But when it comes to the Oscars, Brad Pitt will win the Oscar for best supporting
actor.
Right,
for
that's
sure.
where I'll have the chance. But I think they're both magnificent, but I agree. It's very close between, like, who is the star of this movie? The story in Tarantino said, this is a Rick Dalton story.
Yes.
DiCaprio is the lead. The story is about him. Cliff is there supporting him. But the way that Brad Pitt is so magnetic. I don't remember a time where Brad Pitt has been this good
Inglourious
in a long
Bastards.
Time. Yeah, but it's a different kind. I mean, he's great in Inglourious Bastards, but it's not as deep as this role.
Yeah,
like, this
yeah,
is him acting. I mean,
yeah, Inglourious Bastards. I mean, he plays a cartoon.
It's a fun, funny.
Yeah, he plays it well, yeah. But it's
there's a difference between being cool
right.
and funny, and this is like Oscar-worthy acting
easily.
And so I don't remember a time. It's been a long time since Brad Pitt has done this.
Yeah.
And I mean, it reminds you why he's a movie star.
I did get that trailer for Ad Astra as well, and I was like, it's funny. We talked about, I remember when like Gravity came out. We're just like, we're gonna see this rush of space movies, and here we are. What, 3 years later, and we're still getting them. Like,
yeah,
they're
we've
still
seen
coming
a lot.
Out. You know, yeah. Yeah. So they do a little interview. They explain who they are to the viewer, basically, and just there's something about the way this is shot that I thought was brilliant. Like it's the way it's edited. Is it's shot from both sides, but you never see the camera on either side of them. Like, it was just a really quick and smart. I liked it a lot.
I really like how, and they do that later when they show you how a scene is filmed.
Yeah.
What's really interesting is they show you the film as it's being filmed as opposed to being broadcast. Like, they show you like you're watching a filmed finished piece, but they never show you like a camera watching a camera filming someone
right.
else. And I think that's really interesting because we've seen so many of these type of shots in film over the years, and Tarantino does something completely different where, like, you know, you're watching behind the scenes, like from people that are there watching this being filmed, but there's no camera guy.
Right.
And it's just a really interesting, unique thing. And I liked it. Worked well when you're telling the story, which is supposed to be about these actors and stuntmen and the making of film.
Right.
Right. You're supposed to be there and you're not at home in the audience. You're there with them,
right.
but you're not taken out by the camera crew.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So we cut forward to,
let me just say one more thing about
yeah.
that black and white piece at the beginning of where they're being interviewed by a guy. It would be the equivalent of today, Entertainment Tonight, doing we were on the set with these two guys, and we essentially asked them one question each, and that's our whole, and thanks for joining us.
Join us. Yeah. Yeah, right.
That's the whole thing. It was that superficial.
Right.
And that's how they actually used to do the little film clips in the late 50s and early 60s that were shown in movie theaters instead of trailers.
Mm. Oh, okay.
Not just on TV. That what you saw there was not a TV clip. That was a movie clip to promote a TV show.
Ah, interesting. Okay.
And that's a great way to establish characters, you know, and I talk about one of my pet peeves is lazy exposition and spoon feeding the audience information to learn who these actors are, actor and a stuntman and these characters through a television interview that would have happened at the time. That is smart writing.
Yeah.
That is how you introduce your characters and establish this world and Hollywood and the time period without, you know, having to really take time to shove it down. Oh yeah, you know, oh, I've got to go to the movie set because I am employed by the, you know what I mean, like it's clever the way he does it.
Movie right. set, what do you do on the movie set? Well, I'm starring in a western.
Yeah, exactly.
At the front gate telling the security guard.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I really love how you're off to the races, and then the title credits play and you see Brad Pitt driving Leo around and to this bar, and we eventually figure out why that is.
Yeah, voiceover by Kurt Russell.
Yeah.
So yeah, basically the DiCaprio lost his driver's license from too many DUIs, and they took it. So Cliff, Brad Pitt, is basically his gopher at this point. So they go to this meeting. It's Al Pacino.
You had to get a lot of DUIs in the 60s.
You ain't kidding, brother.
To lose a driver's license.
Or you had to kill somebody.
Yeah.
So he has a meeting with Al Pacino, who, I got to tell you, I don't know if he was wearing makeup, but
he looked young.
I was going the opposite.
Oh, I mean, Al Pacino's getting up there.
I guess we'll find out how he looks in The Irishman.
When the face apps, I guess they de-age
him. Yeah.
I thought Al Pacino looked very, like, he's looking older if you see him behind the scenes type of stuff. I thought he was on. He was
He's great.
He was great.
I disagree. I thought he was the one person in this movie who was horribly miscast.
Oh, interesting. We need somebody
to play an old Jewish guy.
Right.
agent. Who can we get? Oh, how about Al Pacino? It's like in the movie The Comedian, where the Jewish comedian is played by Danny DeVito. Really? You couldn't find anybody else who would fit it a little bit better? Plus, I thought Pacino's over-the-top style that he's done for, I don't know, 20 years.
Ever since Scent of a Woman.
Every single scene he's chewing the scenery was not necessary for this character.
Okay. Interesting. It's such a minor role. It's really not that important to the story, but I just thought he looked youthful because when you see Pacino, and it's not trying to bag on the guy. He's been around for a long time, and I'm like, wow, he's got the energy. I was
okay with the scenery chewing just because, like, I feel like this type of character would be a really big personality. You know what I mean? I could see that.
Yeah,
like, I felt like they would be
like a Swifty Lazar.
Yeah, just really like big.
That's how I felt too. He's an agent. He's like, you know, this is how, you know, I'm a rich agent.
But he's also kind of a bottom feeding agent.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So he's got to overcompensate.
Yeah, but that's how much he overplays it. I agree with you. That would be a guy who was really upbeat and loud. But Pacino overdoes that.
So it's interesting. It's an idea in Hollywood that I never even thought about, where Rick Dalton is an established badass hero on this show called Bounty Law. He inadvertently gets bounty.
He was 10 years earlier.
Well, right. He inadvertently gets Bounty Law canceled because he wanted to try his hand at act in Hollywood
movies.
So now
that's something you probably have to explain to the kids.
I guess that's
today,
true.
That there used to be this divide between
movies and TV.
Movies and TV, and that, like, the real actors, the real celebrity was in movies and TV was lesser than.
Yeah.
You know?
So he basically says, and I never even thought that this would, but it makes complete sense, where Rick Dalton failed in Hollywood, kind of, never really found his footing.
Most of them did.
Right.
Most TV actors could not make the jump to the big screen.
Right.
That was
Clint Eastwood. Like, I'm thinking like guys back then who probably did make that jump in Eastwood.
Steve McQueen,
Eastwood.
Burt Reynolds.
Mm-hmm. That's all I can really think of.
There weren't a ton.
Yeah. So, and then basically Pacino
Bruce
says...
Bruce Dern was actually on, I think, Lancer.
Oh, really?
I think, so Bruce Dern was actually in one of those shows that they show the fake flashback footage to or whatever, the recreated
footage.
No, they're
doing Lancer.
Well, whatever putting them in older stuff.
Right.
Bruce Dern, I think it was Lancer.
That's funny.
That I saw a little Easter egg that Bruce Dern was actually in it. And so it's kind of funny that he shows up later.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
So he lays it out. He was like, look, you used to be you were the badass. You were the top dog. And now these other shows are going, you're always the bad guy, right? And he's like, yeah, I'm always the bad guy. He's like, and you always lose at the end, right? He's like, well, yeah, I'm the bad guy. He's like, right. But they're using you to make their star look better. So like when the main actor of Lancer knocks you out,
James Stacy
knocks you out, like that builds his cred and your star starts to fall. And DiCaprio's just like, crap. He's like, but I got a guy in Rome. Like, if you want to come with us, like, you can do these spaghetti westerns, which is basically what they were. Which some of them are amazingly bad and some of them are amazingly good.
They were given free reign. So if you were a good director, you were going to make an amazing movie.
That's exactly
right. If you were not a good director,
you were going to make a not amazing movie.
You were going to make a very
amazing
movie.
I want those posters.
Yeah. Like the fake ones they made for him. Yeah.
Yes. I want those bad.
And there's no secret that Tarantino's a huge fan of spaghetti westerns and the Italian cinema.
And
so this movie title is based on two Sergio Leone films, Once Upon a Time in America and Once Upon a Time in the West.
Yeah. Yeah. So he has a breakdown. He's just like, and it's interesting that I don't know if the stutter was a DiCaprio choice.
Yeah. I was
to give him a stutter, but
I was confused by this because when he's talking at first, I didn't really hear it. And then when he's talking to Pacino, he really has it.
When he gets anxious, it comes out.
Because that's what I was trying to follow, because I'm like, well, wait a minute, he didn't have a stutter. Now he clearly does. And then he loses it for the rest of the movie for the most part. And then
it comes back.
He loses it when he's doing scenes.
Yeah.
But when he's offset, he has it.
He's then. Mel Tillis. Do you know who he was?
No. Yeah.
Mel Tillis was a country singer who sang beautifully. and he would like go on the Carson show or the Mike Douglas show or whatever it was and sit down, and he had this horrible stutter. And the first time he did it, everybody was like, oh, he's making fun of people who stutter. Why is he doing that? People weren't, people weren't quite that woke yet.
Right. Yeah.
So, you know, they weren't tweeting how horrible this was. But he actually had a horrible stutter except when he performed.
Well, that's why I didn't get, because he didn't have it in the scenes. And so I'm like, well, how could you be an actor if you're...
Because a lot of the way stutters work for a lot of people is that if you give them lines to say and you put them on stage, the stutter goes away.
Yeah.
It was like when I was in high school, there was a kid with a horrible stutter that tried out for the plays, and we were like, are you kidding me?
I mean,
but
you
gave him lines, he was fine. You try to talk to him and he would get stuck.
Huh.
And so that's a very real thing.
It's the opposite of Al Pacino. In real life, Al Pacino's quiet.
Right. Reserved. Yes. Yes. Yeah, right, right. So
talks like a human being.
Right. He has a little bit of a breakdown, and of course Cliff is
and
there.
Has and has a Yiddish accent.
Yeah. Cliff is right there with him and kind of keeps him in check. I do like where he's like, put your glasses on, don't cry in front of the Mexicans.
Yeah.
And it's in, so obviously in past movies with Tarantino, he has, I hesitate to say the word embraced the N-word, but it has been
fair to say. Like,
and he does not do that in this one. And I think he can't anymore.
I think
you can get away with that in Django, given the times, you know, the period piece of what that is.
Yeah.
I think you get away with it there, but I don't think
you're telling a different story.
When he comes out of his mouth in Pulp Fiction, even when I saw that, I was like,
Time, it was like, whoa. Go rewatch 48 Hours.
Oh, it's so interesting you should say that. So I just listened to a podcast with Chris Jericho and Dave Bautista, and how they were talking about movies like that.
Of course you did.
Of course, yes.
Go you.
Yes.
Go on.
But they were talking about Stuber and how Stuber was, they wanted to do like a 48 Hours. Mm-hmm. And so the director of Stuber was like, go watch 48 Hours. And Bautista was like, I went everywhere. And you can't find it.
It's on streaming. Just go.
Well, but like either way, like it was.
I checked Redbox. It wasn't there. So
could find it. But like he said you can't see that on TV anymore.
Gotcha.
Like a movie like 48 Hours, you will never see on TV ever. Because Nick Nolte is a alcoholic racist.
Yeah.
And uses that word a lot.
Yeah.
But there's plenty of like, you know, the damn hippies, and which I got a kick out of because, yeah, damn hippies.
Well, I mean, it's definitely a kind of a think piece on, I think, Tarantino trying to wrestle with his place in pop culture, right?
Like interesting.
You have these two aging celebrities, or aging celebrity and his stuntman.
Right.
And they came up in a different time.
Sure.
And the world is changing drastically around them. And they're at this moment in time where both worlds coexist.
That time in the 60s is a very interesting time
because you have the
World War II vets,
the burgeoning of the new filmmakers starting up. You have The Graduate and you have Easy Rider and
Rosemary's Babies.
You have these movies getting made side by side with
Dr. Doolittle
and Sound of Music and
The Searchers
would have
a little
been
bit earlier.
Earlier, but so you have, you know, and that's in the, and then especially in television.
Yeah,
television was really still. You know, I mean, Westerns had died out, but only because space stuff.
And Batman.
In 69, like the Monkees would have just ended. Like, you still would have had, you know, that wouldn't have been that far removed from Gidget. Bewitched is still on television. I Dream of Jeannie. Like, you have all these really high concept,
right,
cheesy television shows.
Yeah, TV's version of the hip teenager was Goldie Hawn on Laugh-In.
Yeah.
That's true.
And that was edgy television. I mean, really the only kind of representation of like the hippie movement you probably would have had on television at this point
was Goldie Hawn.
Would have been what, Laugh-In and Smothers Brothers, right?
Yes. Smothers Brothers, really.
Yeah. I mean,
and you wouldn't have seen a character from that generation portraying a real person until Mike Stivic, Rob Reiner in All in the Family.
Yeah. And when you would see like a hippie type, it would be on Dragnet and they'd be getting arrested.
For right. Sure.
You know what I mean? Like it was TV was still very reactionary. And
the music was so wrong.
Yeah. I mean, that's part of why the Monkees music worked, right? Is because it was actually hit good songs.
Rock and roll.
Right. Like it's, you know, even though it was manufactured, they hired the right people to manufacture.
I'm surprised they didn't try to use a Beach Boys song in this movie.
Yeah. I don't know. That was such a different thing. But
I'm just saying, like,
he did try to get a monkey song.
Oh, he did?
He wanted to use a song called Teardrop City, which is kind of Last Train to Clarksville played Sideways.
And they said no?
I don't know why he couldn't get it. I just saw the headline and I forgot to go look at the article later.
If I was an artist and then Tarantino was like, I want to put your song on my movie. It's interesting. Like, I was thinking about this. There are, I think he, between him and James Gunn, those are the kind of like the two guys that can take music and make it work.
Yeah.
In their
movies. They both really know how to
incorporate it.
To repurpose existing songs.
And not popular songs. The quasi-popular songs.
Yeah, like for the most part, they're known songs, but they're not the obvious choices.
Right, right. Yeah. So, yeah, so they're kind of driving home, and we see the Manson girls for the first time. Harley Quinn Smith is in there as well, which I thought was interesting. They're very, the way he plays it, it's like, we know who they are. And it's interesting, like, there's a whole generation that I don't think knows who they are.
Sure.
You know, like, that doesn't understand that how terrifying.
This movie definitely relies on you coming into the movie knowing things.
Knowing things, exactly.
And I don't mean that as an insult.
Like, no.
I don't think you have to, but I think that it plays on two different levels. Katie didn't know anything about it, and she loved this movie.
Yeah.
And she's also not a Tarantino fan, and she absolutely loved it, knew nothing about the backstory. She thought
she
this was
anything
all,
about the Manson murders?
No. She thought this was all fictional, and I explained to her, this really happened, except blah, 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 blah.
Something happens in the end that doesn't.
But she thought it was fascinating, so she loved it knowing nothing about it. So I don't think it relies on it, but it does give you two separate viewing experiences.
Yeah. Yeah, that's probably true.
You mean there really was a TV show called Hullabaloo? Yes, honey, there was.
Yeah, so you can go into this completely blind and love it just for what it is. Like, Tarantino sucks you in with these characters and this world that he's built, which is based on reality, but also it's so immersive the way that he recreates Hollywood, the way he recreates buildings and all these TV shows that he's recreating. Like, he does such a good job of establishing this world that it doesn't matter if you know it existed or some of these things were real or not. He's created this thing that you just believe is a thing, whether it's his own creation or not. You don't ever go like, oh, that's a set. It's so real.
It was interesting. There's a scene where we see a superimposed Leo DiCaprio into The Great Escape.
Which is perfect.
Which was fine. But I found it interesting that they didn't superimpose Margot Robbie into the Sharon Tate
stuff.
He did
that for a reason.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, he wanted to
make sure that Sharon Tate was on screen.
Yeah, he wanted to pay tribute. There's a scene where she's watching herself in a movie, and it is really Sharon Tate. And he wanted to give her that moment. He didn't want to take away from Sharon Tate. He obviously has a love for this actor that, you know, was taken far too soon.
Do you think she, I'm asking you to this because you would probably know. Do you think that she is on the level of River Phoenix where, like, if she had survived?
No.
She would have been a megastar?
This is a woman who was in Valley of the Dolls and a Matt Helm, Dean Martin movie, the last of that series called The Wrecking Crew.
Right.
She was fine, but she wasn't somebody who was going to go on to amaze people on screen.
I'm just in my mind that if River Phoenix doesn't die, he's DiCaprio.
River Phoenix was incredible.
He would have DiCaprio's career.
I agree, but the only asterisk I would put on that is that we don't know what Polanski would have put her in. That might have given us a different take on her.
Maybe.
You know she just didn't appear to have that it factor, though, right off the cuff.
But she's not going to get the Faye Dunaway role in Chinatown.
No.
Oh, no. I see what you're saying. That's fair.
Yeah.
Tarantino doesn't just do things.
No, totally.
Tarantino has a reason. It's his way or the highway. You don't give him notes. You don't give him changes. You read the lines that he puts in the script. Tarantino has a vision and an idea, and no one messes with
that. Well, wasn't that whole DiCaprio scene in Django ad-libbed? That whole scene where he smashes the skull, I think, is...
I think maybe with someone like DiCaprio, he'll give him a little bit of a take. You know, even maybe
he'll let him do it his way. But like,
film what he has set, and then if you do a little extra because the film's still rolling, do something. Okay, and Tarantino might even go, I love this, just show me this. You know, like, you know, but that's what a good director does.
Sure.
But what I mean is, though, if it's on the screen, Tarantino wanted it.
Right.
He doesn't mess around with, you know, it's his way or the highway.
But speaking of Margot Robbie, how wonderful is she just reacting to the people around her reacting to the movie?
She's great.
It's funny, like, when you look at her career, where it's just like, okay, she's the eye candy in Wolf of Wall Street. Fine.
And a lot of actors have begun their careers as the eye candy.
Yeah.
Jessica Lange.
Brad Pitt.
Totally.
Yeah. I mean, Brad Pitt and Thelma and Louise.
Thelma and Louise, yeah.
You know what I mean? So it's not just, I mean, it happens to women more than it happens to men.
And by the way, he's still eye candy when he takes his shirt off.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Three women around me made this sound.
Yeah. But Jason Momoa was on Baywatch. Now he's an A-list megastar. People...
Yeah, but she, to me, she is on a different level. Like, she is still major league beautiful, but she also has that...
She's a really good actress.
Yes, oh, yeah. She's
well,
really
Brad
good.
Brad Pitt does, too.
I haven't gotten to Brad Pitt yet. But, I mean, Brad Pitt is established. Margot Robbie, yeah. I mean, is still fairly...
Early
in her career.
29. Tanya?
Yeah. Oh,
she's
absolutely.
Only 29.
Yeah. And she's a heavy hitter in Hollywood. Like, she's no, like, I think she has like a first look deal with Warner Brothers. And she's kind of, I think she's going to be their linchpin in the DC, whatever is going to come out of that. She's going to be one of the cornerstones.
She's really good for sure. But I think the point is, if you go back and watch movies and now, if you go back to watch movies from 10, 20, 30 years ago, you start seeing people, oh my God, they were in this, because everyone starts somewhere.
Right.
You don't just start out as Meryl Streep, like where Meryl Streep is now.
Right.
You know
what
I mean?
Right,
like
right.
It's just people, they start out in these little roles and then someone goes, there's something here. This person's amazing. And then they put them in their,
right, yeah.
you know, star making roles.
Meryl Streep played Woody Allen's ex-wife in, I think it was Manhattan.
And
you see her on the street and you say, oh, she's beautiful.
Yeah.
Now let's get back to the Woody story. Yeah. No, nobody went, oh my God, find out who that actress is.
Right. That's the first time when I watched Manhattan and I saw Meryl Streep and I didn't know what she looked like when she was younger. And I'm like, wow, she was gorgeous. And I just, you know, not that she's unattractive now, but I hadn't seen her at 19 and it's like, wow. But yeah, she was in that little role. And so everyone starts somewhere. But Margot Robbie has proven herself certainly.
Yeah.
And there was at Cannes, there was a little, panel with the cast, and someone had asked, why didn't you give Margot Robbie very many lines? And Tarantino just kind of dismissed that because, you know, he does what he does for a reason. But then Margot Robbie was like, she didn't, to understand this character, you didn't need to have that much spoken. You take in her experience with the people and the reactions.
The scene that got me with her is the scene where Charlie walks up to the house, because the house that they stay in was used to be one of the Beach Boys' house, and that's Charlie had a connection with Brian Wilson.
Yeah, it was Dennis Wilson's house.
Is that what it was?
I think so, yeah.
But there's just the way that you can see her innocence. She doesn't say a goddamn word.
Yeah.
She's standing in the doorway looking at Charlie Manson. And I mean, we know what's going to happen.
That was an intense scene.
And I think it's also kind of shows how little someone knows about acting. You think the only way to act is by talking.
Yeah exactly.
You know
exactly.
I mean? It's about screen time. If she was in the movie for 3 minutes, which is what I was expecting after that story.
That's what I thought,
right.
too.
And I was like, well, that's an odd choice. Like, I thought it was
like a stunt casting type
thing. Yeah, I was reserving judgment until I saw the film, but I thought, well, that's an odd choice. But watching her watch the movie and realizing, okay, she's never going to get a lot of lines in this movie. That's not what this role is.
Yeah.
But to watch that thing, that scene, and think that she's not acting.
Oh, for sure.
It's also insulting.
Well, I can see where people would think that she was going to be fodder. Look, here's the deal. Sherman Tate, Vortech, and Abigail Folger, and Jay Sebring are dead. Like, the Manson family murdered them.
Yeah.
So I could see where if you go into this movie knowing that history, you're like, okay, she's just fodder. Like, this whole cast, they're not going to last long because they're going to be gutted and murdered and thrown all over this house.
There's a sense of foreboding in every scene she's
in. It's very Hitchcock, mm-hmm. where you know that history, you know that story, you know what's coming, and they play it
the entire time. And I think that's why this movie's brilliant.
I agree.
Because you watch every scene knowing that, but you didn't know.
When they get to the end and they start building and building and building, and I was like, oh, God.
It's coming.
And they make you care about, they don't really make you care about Emile Hirsch, who plays J.C. Bringer, or the other two characters. But they make you care about her in that scene in the movie theater, in the scene at the restaurant. Like, she's so good on screen that
she's
charming. Having 3 pages of dialogue,
maybe
but they make you care about her, mm-hmm. and you know what's coming to, you know, and it's not.
And I think ultimately she ends up kind of being the voice of Tarantino in the film.
Yeah.
Especially the whole part about Paul Revere and the Raiders.
Yeah.
Where she's just like, look, it's a good song or it's not a good song. get out of this hipster mentality of whether or not it's cool.
Right.
Or it, like, it's like, does this song work?
Yep.
Yes.
I like that.
Exactly.
Now, to your point, Tom, I was just going to say, do you know what Tarantino said when that person asked, why didn't you give her very many lines to say?
Uh-uh.
He just said, I reject your hypothesis. So, to your point, it's just he was just totally dismissed it because, like, that's ridiculous.
Yeah.
Because he knew why he did it, and he put her on screen for that much time, and Margot Robbie had so many beautiful moments that made you fall in love with that character slash person, even if you didn't know she existed. Someone like Katie wouldn't have understood that,
right.
But she still loved that character that he created. So
just watching her listening to a Paul Revere and the Raiders album.
Yes, right. Exactly. Fantastic. So that's why when someone asked that question, he just was like, next, because you didn't get it.
Yeah.
Right. That, you missed the whole point.
And one other thing about Paul Revere and the Raiders, you mentioned the people that lived in the house next door.
Mm-hmm.
Mark Lindsay, who was Paul Revere or Paul Revere and the Raiders.
Madam.
Mark Lindsay lived there with his producer, Terry Melcher, and actress Candice Bergen. They moved there in late 66. And in 1968, Charles Manson went to a meeting there facilitated by Dennis Wilson of the Beach Boys. But they moved out, and Manson didn't know.
Yeah.
And so when he went back and ended up having his people kill the people there, he thought he was going after those people who rejected him because he wanted a music career.
He was trying to sell songs to the Beach Boys.
It's there. If you go on, if you can find it, there's like a six-track album of Charlie Manson songs.
Yeah.
Like, they're out there. And they're
Guns N' Roses got in trouble for covering one.
Only did.
A million years ago on the spaghetti incident.
Okay.
And
they're not bad.
And
like, they're very 60s.
Yeah. And people were upset because it's like, well, that means Manson got a paycheck.
Now,
like, he owns the rights to that song.
Now, here's the great thing about this. Terry Melcher, who was the producer for Mark Lindsay, Paul Revere, and the Raiders, listened to Manson's songs in the house that day and said no, but then reconsidered and then went out to have a meeting with Manson at the Spahn
Ranch
where Manson got into a drunken fight with a drunken stuntman.
Yep.
Yeah.
It's all there. Yeah. Like, Tarantino gets it.
This
he
is
knows
based
the...
on, I mean, there is a lot of truth here. This may be a fairy tale, as we established, but it is based on a lot of real events. And
Tarantino knows stuff.
He did his research.
That's what they should have called this movie.
I don't think he did any research. I just think he already knew it.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So they, you know, that's the thing is this movie, much like all of his stuff, his older stuff, his newer stuff didn't really focus on, like, the multiple storylines and then tie them all up together.
Pulp Fiction.
No, I mean, his early stuff did that.
I feel like
Inglorious Bastards didn't do that.
Oh, like
Django.
The middle stuff.
Yeah,
it was more straight
Kill Bill
narratives.
And all that stuff didn't really do that. This one kind of goes back to that framework where you've got the Polanski and Sharon Tate, you've got Cliff, you've got
Rick,
you've got all these different characters kind of circling, and the Manson family circling each other, and then they all kind of get tied up at the end. So the Cliff comes to pick up Rick. They kind of go to the set to this new Western that he's going to be the bad guy on. Cliff goes back to the house. We keep seeing this one girl keep showing back up, and of course they keep missing each other. And it's interesting, like, they could have made Brad Pitt a scumbag, and they went out of their way to ensure that he was the hero.
They alluded to the fact that he might be a scumbag. Like,
no, when he asked that girl for her, like, he
okay, but.
But at the same time, we don't know if he murdered his wife.
Well, you don't know if he murdered his wife, right? But also in that scene, like, it was basically like, I know how the law works. It wasn't like, you're too young for me, kid.
Right.
It was like, I'm not going to make a misstep that's going to put me in jail. So the way that scene is written, while he makes the right decision, you don't entirely know if he made it for the right reasons.
And by the way, the scene where he tells... Or somebody's talking about him, and they talk about him killing his wife.
It's flashback.
They're talking about him on the boat.
Yeah.
Was he married to Natalie Wood?
I thought the same thing.
Is that what we're supposed to think?
That's what I think.
I mean,
thought he was absolutely Natalie
Wood. It's alluding to the Natalie
Wood.
So
he's Wood Robert
thing.
Wagner.
Yes.
See, I didn't read it as Natalie Wood. I just assumed that spear gun was about to go off.
Oh, I think he pushed her over. Well, yeah.
And he's holding that spear gun.
And he pushed her over.
And they're fighting. And I just took it as, like, that spear gun's about to go off. Was that an accident or not?
But I think it drew inspiration from Natalie Wood. So
yeah,
that's what most people are making that comparison. But what I love that Tarantino does is he never shows you either way. Those are the rumors. Like, he's saying that, you know, he has this reputation and people call him wife murderer and all this. But they never show that happening.
No.
There's no... So you can argue it either way. Is it the tale? Is it the, you know, is it the rumors?
It's 60s Hollywood.
Yeah, or did he actually do it? And so I really like how he didn't show it one way or the other.
And that's why I think that scene plays both ways. It does. Even though he makes the right call.
It's the top.
It's like, but why is he making the right call?
Right. I get you. Yeah, for sure.
And so I think the jury is deliberately out on whether or not this character.
Well, I think,
you end up landing on liking the character because it's Brad Pitt.
Sure. Very likable.
In the same way, like in Paper Moon, you never know for sure if they're father and daughter.
Right.
But you're going to land on them being father and daughter because they cast a father and daughter.
Sure.
Right.
Right.
But in the book, it's a little bit more
wishy-washy.
Like, well, it's not. It's just like nobody knows. There's no real way of knowing.
Right.
And so they become father and daughter. Gotcha. In the movie, they become, you know, that relationship forms. But you kind of always assume that they really are biologically related because they cast biologically related. Yeah.
But I'm with
people.
You, Joe. I think they paint him as a good guy, and I think that they give you no reason to root against Cliff Booth.
And especially when we get to the scene at the ranch,
yeah,
where even he's just like, and
he's
always doing the right thing. If we can get Tarantino to do a horror movie, sign me up, because that scene at the ranch
was nuts.
There's a lot to like in this movie, and that's why I started by saying it's the best movie I didn't like, because there are lots of things to like about this movie.
Okay, here's a little movie detail that bothered me and I had to think about on the way home that night. Margaret Qualley plays the teenage girl who he picks up, who's a member of the Manson family. He doesn't know it, but he has suspicions about it. And she has armpit hair.
She does.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think Tarantino told her, don't shave your armpit for 6 months, or did she get an armpit merkin?
I think it looked natural, as much as armpit hair can look natural.
Yeah, but Damian Lewis looked like Steve McQueen, and he's not.
So that's So we should say that there's a lot of Mama Cass is in this movie.
Yeah,
but she doesn't have any lines. Michelle Phillips.
I would think. Yeah, you would think if she was going to grow her armpit hair out, she would also stop shaving her legs.
Yeah,
that's a good point.
And her legs were shaved.
Yeah, unless that girl. She's a name I don't recognize in that Manson family. But they don't really talk about the ones that didn't do anything. Like, there were so many people at that ranch.
Right.
But I want, like, hooking was a form of income for them. And I wonder if she kept that, you know, as an appeal to pick up Johns. I don't know.
Who knows?
I just wanted to say the word merkin on this show. Has anybody ever done that before?
I mean, given our track record, probably. Brad Pitt kind of picks him up, takes him to the set, and he kind of says, he's like, hey, did you ask about me getting some work on here? He's like, yeah, like the dude who runs this thing is friends with so-and-so.
And it also shows, like, non-lazy exposition.
Yes.
It illustrates his fading star.
Yes.
That he can't even get this guy
get some work.
Some day work as a stuntman.
He was like, he was the so-and-so, the PA on the Green Hornet.
The way that you learn about these characters, the way it's written to then flash back to these things and learn who these people are and what happened and why is he an ex-stuntman or he can't get work as a stuntman now. I just think it was brilliant the way that Tarantino built this world. He didn't force it. He didn't rush you into anything. It's like he let it naturally learned about the characters through their conversations,
right?
And then they would show you little bits and just through them talking, it's like we completely understood who Rick and Cliff were and
their relationship.
Yeah. And I haven't felt this way about a movie in a long time, where I was just sucked in, and for a second halfway through the movie I forgot I was watching a movie.
Very rarely will I go back and see a movie a second time.
Yeah.
But this one was one of, I went back and I was like, I gotta see it.
I couldn't stop thinking about it. I mean, I snapped out of it. It was one of the Brad Pitt driving scenes, which Tom was mentioning earlier. But for the first time in a long time, it was like when you are driving home from work and then you're at home and you're like, how'd I get here?
Yeah.
I snapped out of it and I'm like, I'm watching a movie. Like, I was so sucked into
the
these characters
are very real.
And this movie that I have not been lost. Like, I'll be watching a movie and I'll think of something else, or maybe I'll check the time on my phone, or, you know, sometimes I'll just zone out and do something real quick and then get back to it.
Right.
This movie, just, I was in.
Yeah.
You know, the irony is, like, I would not watch this movie again, but if they do the 4-hour Netflix version, I would watch that.
Yeah.
Because
I haven't done Have you done The Hateful Eight yet?
Is it on Netflix?
Oh,
the longer version?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's like a 4-hour, it's a 1-hour block.
Oh, I didn't realize that they had actually put that out.
They did.
I knew they were talking. I thought they were still talking.
Oh,
about
no.
It. No, I have not. Because I liked Hateful Eight.
The one that I'm surprised they have is the whole Bloody Affair. I don't know why they just don't put that out.
How much extra is supposed? It's the two movies
it's
put
two
together.
Movies put together.
But is there extra then
I
in between
so.
Too?
Yeah, oh, okay. For sure.
Because Kill Bill, he said it. I mean, he counts that as one movie.
Right.
They just split it into two, but it is one story.
Yeah.
And they instead of making a 4.5-hour movie or whatever, they released it as two, and that worked out. But they don't count it as like Tarantino's, you know, 9th and 10th movie or whatever. It's he counts it as one.
Oh, they
movie.
Do. Okay.
One and two are counted as one.
So we get a little bit of a flashback, and this is the scene that has caused probably the most controversy in the entire movie is the portrayal of Bruce Lee in this scene. And so I love that. Those are some of the earliest action movies I've ever seen. I fell in love with that guy. He's an amazing. And the fact that Shannon Lee, who is the only surviving child of Bruce and his wife, kind of tore Tarantino a new asshole about the portrayal. And it's just kind of, and look, I can respect the fact that he's your dad and he has this legacy of being, kind of like a spiritual leader as well as like a revolutionary. Your dad was a cocky son of a bitch. Like at that early in his career on the Green Hornet, like that he was so popular that in China and Japan, like it was called the Kato Show. Like the Green Hornet wasn't even a thing. It was the Kato Show.
Wow.
So the fact that I feel like that's an accurate portrayal of Bruce Lee at that point where some old stuntman runs his mouth to Bruce Lee and Bruce Lee's like, what? Like, okay, like let's do this right now. And they don't allude to you don't know what happens in that third fall. Bruce Lee gets him. That's 2 out of 3 falls. I knock you. No hits to the face because you're too pretty to be a stuntman. And I'm Bruce Lee. Like I'm the lead of this movie of the show. And he's going on and on about Muhammad Ali or Cassius Clay at that time. They have a T-shirt on Bruce Lee's official website of a superimposed Bruce Lee against Muhammad Ali. And it's just like you can't complain about the portrayal of Bruce Lee and how Bruce Lee would never.
Well, but I don't know why that shirt would say anything negative about Bruce Lee.
It's
I mean,
not, but what I'm saying,
he would fight a lot of people that he didn't necessarily dislike.
Well,
like
what, he,
was
what
the
she's
job.
Saying is like Bruce Lee would never think of challenging Cassius Clay. Like he would never even it would never even cross his mind.
Did she say that? I thought she said that
she
he
did.
Would,
she said he had the utmost respect for Muhammad Ali, and that in the movie he's like, I could take him. Like
well,
he
yeah.
talks,
had but he's talking in front of a group of guys.
Yeah.
Had you Ali know? Fought the kickboxer yet by 1969?
No, he wasn't doing stunt stuff yet.
He like, was still like, he was still Cassius no, Clay. Yeah. He did that.
No, he wasn't. No, he changed Cassius Clay in the mid 60s.
But they refer to him as Cassius Clay in this movie.
That's because some people still did that.
Oh, that's probably true. Okay.
But he was definitely Muhammad Ali by 1969.
Okay.
And I you know, I
but
think,
we're not at
I
16.
Think,
oh, yeah, we are.
I you're think right. the fights with Frazier and Foreman, those were in the early 70s. So, yeah, you're probably right. It's another 10 years before he has that horrible thing against the kickboxer.
Yeah.
But which was such a debacle.
But my point is,
but I don't.
If you're going to say that that Bruce Lee would never challenge.
But he starts off having nothing but respect for Muhammad Ali because he's saying he doesn't like how you fight in martial arts
right.
because you're not really fighting. He's like, it's all just an elaborate show and it's stupid.
Right.
And he's like, the boxers are really punching each other. They're really taking each other on.
But then, he does say, if I fought Cassius
Clay, he would be a stain.
Yeah.
Is what he said.
Yeah.
But I don't even know if that's disrespecting him because I still think like if you're
it's bravado.
If you're going to get into the ring and go toe to toe with somebody, you better damn well think you're going to kick their ass.
I totally agree with you.
You know what I mean?
You two are both on the same page. Yeah. You're saying it differently, but
but my point is then she's like he would never say that. It's like you are selling a shirt with your father and Muhammad Ali facing off with each other in the ring. So like you can't say that and then still sell the shirt.
Yeah.
You know, like, and again, they're,
and I guess Shannon, what I'm saying is I don't think selling that shirt is disrespectful because Bruce Lee, I'm sure, fought a lot of people.
Sure.
That he didn't disrespect.
What
you're going to fight. That's the job.
What I'm
know?
Saying is Shannon can't say that he would never say that.
Yeah.
And then sell the shirt with the thing that he would never do on it.
I'm going to say this right now. If Tom O'Keefe fought Muhammad Ali right now, Ali's a dead man.
I think I could still find a way to lose.
But like, so, and, the, point, and this, this is a great scene.
Any daughter or son is going to defend their father like this. And here, she's doing what any of us would do.
And I will also say, though, this scene is presented as a flashback from the point of view of the Brad Pitt character.
Correct.
So like,
who was kind of an unreliable
narrator.
This could
be his memory.
Right. So like,
right?
We don't know if this really played out exactly the way it's presented to us, because even within the context of the film, it's not presented
exactly.
As this
Cliff is
factual.
Cocky. He's cocky in the scene. So that's a great out, Tom. That's a great out to say this is Cliff's memory of the events. And sure, Bruce Lee probably was cocky too, but maybe he's painting him as really.
I don't think you can do what either of these guys do without being cocky.
Exactly. I like it. I think that's a great. You just explained the whole
and
thing away.
Like I said, so when Bruce Lee died, Shannon was a baby.
Was young,
I mean, not like young, like maybe an infant. Yeah. Because Brandon was. I mean, he couldn't have been more than 10 when he died. So it's like there, I'm sure that there is some hero worship there for, you know, and I get that. But at the same time, you need to look at the context of the scene and realize that they don't go to a third fall because Zoe Bell breaks it up. And which I love that where like, so Brad Pitt kind of throws him into a car and smashes the car door. Zoe Bell kind of walks out and they have a, this is how we find out that Brad Pitt can't really get any work because he kicked the crap out of Bruce Lee.
Yeah, we should say like, Kurt Russell plays the stunt coordinator,
Rick.
and so he is done using Cliff because of, you know, everything that Cliff's done. Yeah, and then the wife rumors and all that, and he gives him one more chance. And what does he do? Cliff fights Bruce Lee, the star of the Black Hornet, and damages his wife's car.
Yeah.
Sorry.
But I like the fact that it's actually Bruce Lee who wants to fight him.
Right.
Yeah.
Brad Pitt doesn't go, come on, let's fight right now. Yeah, it's totally Bruce Lee who says that. And then Zoe Bell comes in and blames Brad Pitt.
Of course.
I do like when Bruce Lee's kind of getting undressed and the guy's like, are you sure you want to do this? And he was like, yeah, look at him. He's like, yeah, but that guy killed his wife. And he goes, that guy killed his wife? And he's like, yeah. He's like, well, all right, I'm already here. But so, yeah, we find that.
Now he can't back up.
Now he can't back up. So then we flash back to Brad Pitt on top of the roof fixing DiCaprio's. And I do like where he kind of goes, yeah, it's fair. Like that line where after the flashback, he's like, nah, it makes sense. That's why I'm not working. DiCaprio kind of finds his footing again and has this ridiculous scene, two scenes with this girl, Mary Bell, who's this actress.
This was amazing. This entire Rick Dalton trying to, it's kind of what he feels like is his last chance to prove to himself, because he doesn't want to go to Italy and do these spaghetti westerns. And he's like, he wants to make it here and still prove that he's worth a damn. And I just, it's amazing what DiCaprio does with this whole arc.
And they've got Timothy Olyphantastic is in this movie.
Who looks just like the real guy.
Yeah.
Again, the casting in this movie is incredible. And it's like everyone that they flashback, these people that are playing other actors from these old shows.
Yeah.
It's amazing when you see them side by side.
I love the Steve McQueen line where he's like, she was married to him, to Jay Sebring. She left Jay Sebring to get with him. And now they're all living together. And Jay Sebring knows that Polish F is going to mess up and he's going to be right there to sweep in and take over and everything's going to be great. I do like the girl where she's like, well, he does have a type. She does have a type.
Yeah,
like short,
like, I never stood a chance.
Do you know who J.C. Bring was?
He was the hairdresser.
He was the hairdresser to the stars.
Yeah. He was the inspiration for Warren Beatty's character in Shampoo.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Played by Emile Hirsch in this.
Yes. And in the scene you're talking about where where Rick is shooting the scenes for Lancer and sits down with the girl. People should know that girl's name is Julia Butters.
She's going to be something.
Name. She's 12 years old, playing an 8-year-old in this movie. I predict next year at the Oscars, she's the kid presenter. Like Jacob Tremblay after Room and Jaden Smith got
great.
To do it.
She was great.
She was great.
And that whole exchange, that whole
the whole thing
of him on the set of that show
fantastic.
Was great.
Oh, incredible. That's the other thing I was talking about earlier. The way they film it, you never see a camera. We're watching like a finished film, but they rewind it and reset the camera. Like, you know, you're watching the camera,
right?
But it's finished. It doesn't look like rough footage or anything.
The thing I liked about that scene is I think it shows you how difficult it is to be an actor on a film set. That like,
oh sure,
when you watch a movie and you're caught up in the moment and you think, oh, I could maybe do this, you know.
Right.
But when you see him flub a line and then call for a line and then but have to like immediately drop back into that character and
I got it.
Yeah,
like when he takes a drink and spits the thing again and just does it so naturally and organically back, there's no pause in time.
Right.
You can tell he's frustrated. Timothy Oliphant's getting frustrated, you know, and it's like he's just like so mad and he doesn't. He takes a drink, spits it out, and then starts doing it again. You're just like, director didn't yell anything at that moment. Like he just did it. And it's incredible the way
he's like, can we cut? He's like, no, keep going, keep going.
Yeah.
But it's interesting, like the two characters that
my only quibble was like, I don't think that there would have been a Western on TV like this back then.
Probably not. Yeah. That's probably true.
Now, in their defense, and this is probably their out, they're shooting a pilot.
Yeah.
Like, we don't know that it ever got picked up.
Lancer was a real TV show that was on ABC in the late 60s.
But they're shooting the pilot when you see it. So I don't know. I've never seen Lancer.
It was on for 2 years. And James Stacey was the real star of the movie.
Okay, yeah.
Of the show, I mean.
Two favorite characters that Timothy Oliphant has played is Raylan Givens and Bullock from Deadwood. And when he shows up in this scene, he is this of combination of Raylan Givens and Bullock. And I was like, just make this guy do this character
Timothy
for
Oliphant in a Western.
Sign me up. Yeah. And that's basically what Justified
what he
was.
Does.
Like, it was just an updated Western, basically.
But yeah, this whole thing, I mean, DiCaprio, we know DiCaprio is an amazing actor.
Yeah.
He proves it with this whole Lancer arc. It is just unbelievable. And when that little girl said that was the best acting I've ever seen, and the reaction that DiCaprio gives her,
Rick fucking Dalton.
That is an amazing, amazing moment in film.
Right.
That just, it's amazing. He I'm going to be interested to see.
He'll get nominated.
He won for the last one, right? His last movie was The Revenant 5 years ago.
Did he win for that?
Didn't he win? Wasn't that his first?
Yes, that's what he won
That's
for.
What he won
that's
for.
His first win. So it's like, I mean, I know it's been 5 years, and this is his first thing since his actual win, but it's like, man, this is
he hasn't made a movie since The Revenant?
He hasn't. Five years.
I have to correct myself. Lancer ran on CBS Tuesday nights at 7:30 from 1968 to 1970. And James Stacey really did star in the show. Mm-hmm. And Wayne Maunder, who was portrayed in the movie by Luke Perry, his last role, the guy from 90210, he was the co-star of this.
Mm-hmm. Oh, really?
Yeah.
It was a real...
A Bonanza knockoff, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
So then this is kind of the end of this era for, because we kind of flash forward a little bit. We find out we go 6 months later, and Rick has decided, you know,
we got to talk about the ranch.
Oh, that's right. That's right. So,
very important here. So
Rick or not Rick, but,
Cliff.
Cliff is driving down and we see the girl again.
Pussycat.
Third time.
Yeah. And she finally, they're going the same way. And he was just like, God damn it. All right. Like, this is going to get me in all kinds of trouble. So she kind of, you know, now this is the most feat.
Tarantino went crazy. We know Tarantino is a foot guy, and he does it in a lot of his movies, from Pulp Fiction, Kill Bill, all that. I did not like the feet in this movie. It's too much, and they're too in the front of the camera.
I didn't mind the Margot Robbie one, because I was like, okay, I'll give you the one.
It was okay. But I know barefoot hippies in the 60s.
This girl puts her feet on the windshield.
It was gross.
Yeah,
see the dirty, gross hippie feet on the windshield closest to the camera, it was gross.
I got to tell you, I saw this movie at a screening. I came home and I told my wife how much I loved it. And I said, you really should go see this movie. And she said, yeah, but it's Tarantino. It's going to be too violent. I said, well, there's some violence at the end, but it's not that bad. She said to me, is it Bruce Willis in the basement in Pulp Fiction violent? And I said, no, it's not that bad. She said, okay, I'll see it. Yesterday, she went to see it, comes home, first thing she says is, what's with the feet?
it was too much. Again, I get that you like it.
Right.
Put some feet in there if you want, but it was too much.
It's a lot of feet.
By the way, she loved it too.
Lots of feet in that movie.
Yeah.
I would also like to point out that the Bruce Willis scene doesn't have any violence.
There's no violence in that
movie. It's all off camera.
Yep.
That's all that violence? That's in your wife's head, man.
Yep. There's no violence in that scene whatsoever.
If you remember, he takes that sword and the guy standing behind him and he pushes back but the blade is below the cut of the screen.
Yep.
Like there is almost no violence in that scene whatsoever.
Okay.
But people remember it. It's the same way people remember Janet Leigh getting stabbed in the shower.
Yeah.
You never see her get stabbed.
No. Yeah. You see Anne Heche's butthole.
I'm gonna let you tell my wife that.
Write me to the next screen, and I'll be like, okay, you're the one that loves the violence, lady.
So yeah, we get Brad Pitt picks up the girl, and he's just like, "Are you going to Spawn Movie Ranch?" And at that point, you're just like, "This is gonna get bad." Like I thought we were going to lose Brad Pitt.
Like, well, that's, yeah, that's what I thought. Yeah, for that's sure. The thing that Quentin Tarantino does, and again, one of the reasons I love this movie so much, is that it managed to surprise you.
Yeah.
We've all seen a lot of movies, and we can pretty much all call what's going to happen in most movies. They're predictable. Even good ones are predictable, like, because you've seen it.
Did you know that they were going to pick up Thor's hammer?
No, I don't remember. But the thing is, it's just like you've seen it, and it's just how many different ways can you do certain things? It's like we've seen it all. And this movie manages to keep surprising you. And that I haven't had that reaction in a theater in a long time.
No,
because,
I agree.
Again, even if I enjoy a movie, I'm like, well, yeah, you knew that was going to happen. You knew it. And this movie made me go like, oh, my gosh. Like, you know, I was worried for Brad Pitt and nothing bad happens to him.
Nope.
And then, of course, that ending is the biggest shock, where I audibly like was gasping and oh, my gosh, like the whole audience went nuts. And I haven't been a part of an audience like that in a long time where, you know, even if I'm having fun or whatever, you know, I hardly laugh out loud. It's got to be really funny.
This movie is probably the funniest Tarantino movie I've ever seen. There's a lot of comedy in this that's actual comedy. That's not like awkward.
Nervous laugh.
Yeah. So he drives the girl out there. She's like, you want me to give you a blowjob while we're driving out there? And he's like, how old are you? And she was like, oh, man, you're
I'm
a
I'm
going
to need to see some
identification. Yeah, I'd be like, she's like, I'm 18. He's like, show me your ID. Yeah. And she was like, what? He's like, right. You don't have an ID.
Yeah.
I've been avoiding to see an x-ray of your wrist.
I've been avoiding the law my entire life, and I ain't going to get cut up for any poontang is the line. And so they drive her out there, and this is all it's so creepy because everybody kind of starts to come out. And we see Lea Dunham comes out, and she kind
of
says...
And then the next 2 hours of the movie is just Midsommar.
So at this point, Cliff knows this isn't right.
Yeah.
Like, his spider sense has gone off.
Right.
Something is wrong. Tex shows up.
It's a bunch of hippies
living on this ranch.
Shouldn't be able to afford living on this huge property. And it's like, well, what are all these kids doing?
And Cliff knows the ranch because he had been there as a stuntman making movies.
Making Bounty Law.
Yeah.
Yeah. The scene where he's just like, does George Spawn still own this ranch? And they're just like, yeah. And he's like, does he still live at that house? And they're just like, yeah. He's like, I'm going to go say hi. He's like, I'm just an old buddy. Like, I'll go say hi. And everybody's kind of like, nope, don't. He's taking a nap. Don't go up there. Don't go up there. I was like, Brad Pitt, don't go up there.
And
like,
the whole time, you know exactly how this is going to go, or so you think.
Yes.
Yeah. They're feeding,
it's a Tarantino movie.
Like, they're feeding him lines. He's going to go in there. He's going to get killed.
Yeah.
The guy's going to be dead. You know how this ends, but you don't.
None of it.
It's just like he manages to shock you in this moment where you're just like, oh.
So
talk about subverting expectations. People love to try to do that now. It's not always easy to do, but it's like you think you know exactly how it goes down.
And it doesn't.
Yeah. They gave it all to you and you rejected it.
You don't realize. So he goes, he's walking to the ranch and all the little Manson girls are like, he's coming up there. This guy's coming up here.
Go get
all, no, they're not yet. But that's happening. So that happens when he punches the guy in the mouth.
Tex goes and checks him out.
Right.
And then he leaves.
So Dakota Fanning,
Tex is the guy that's going to be Elvis.
Oh,
Austin
really?
Butler, I think, is
okay.
His name.
Okay. So Dakota Fanning is in this movie as Squiggy Fromm. She kind of like gives Brad Pitt the guff. Finally, he's like, I gotta tell you right now, I'm coming in there and this screen door ain't going to stop me. So you can either let me in or I'm coming in. And she finally, she like clicks the thing.
Like,
you're dead. Like, you are dead.
Right.
No, you're not making out of this house alive.
And she says, no, he's got to take his nap because we watch FBI and I don't want him falling
Bonanza.
Asleep. And it's like, you're like, she's feeding him this BS.
Right.
He's going to go in there. They're all going to go kill him.
And then he goes in and sees Bruce Dern as George Spawn.
And he shakes him and he doesn't move. And you go, oh, he's going to roll over and be super dead.
We're going to see a corpse. This is going to be Norman Bates' mother.
Yeah,
is in this
exactly. He shakes him.
Nope.
Shakes him.
Totally
he rolls
awake.
Over. Oh. What do you do? Who? What?
Right.
By the way, perfect Bruce Dern.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If you had said, Bruce Dern, could you do Bruce Dern for us? That's what you would get.
Yeah, Bruce Dern.
So they have an interaction, and, you know, he kind of says, like, yep,
and this is the role that was supposed to be
Burt Reynolds. Yeah. I could see that for sure.
But he couldn't do Bruce Dern.
He could not do Bruce Dern. But so
it ended his career.
Yeah.
They have a little back and forth, and finally Brad Pitt's like, I got to go. Like, I need to get out of here. So he takes off and he runs.
But he's like, I got to take my nap because Squeaky gets mad if I fall asleep during FBI. And I just thought this was the most brilliant writing that he says the exact same thing. The Squeaky was not even lying.
No, he's totally telling the truth.
It blew my mind that character and in this situation would not be trying to pull some kind of scam. And I mean, you know.
And that whole family were scam artists.
Yeah.
Like Charlie Manson was a scam artist.
Yeah, if you think Manson family, you don't think a bunch of honest people.
Yeah, right.
But, you know, I looked into the history of it.
He just had a bad day.
Yeah. But this really happened.
It did.
Manson made a deal with Spawn,
yes.
and he promised, you know, there'd be women there, and
yep.
and he, like, this all really happened.
Charlie Manson, the one that we that you seen like that you saw towards the end of his life was not what he was back then. Like back then, he was a charismatic leader of, like, I mean, he was a cult leader, and he had the charisma, and he had the, he was smart.
You're talking pre-forehead swastika.
Yes. Yes. Okay. I'm talking, yeah, like after he got caught and, you know, jail or whatever, and just, you know, but like back then,
look, he got a lot of people, a lot of young women.
He got people to murder, you know?
I mean, yeah.
So yeah. So Brad Pitt kind of walks, and at this point, the family is gone. Like, they've kind of just dispersed, and there's the one girl in there, and she's like, "You're such an embarrassment." And he was like, "Okay." He's like, I think you should leave. He's like, "What?" He's like, do you believe us now?" He's like, "Absolutely not." He's like, "I think you should leave." He's like, "Way ahead of you."
Yeah.
And he goes to his car, and of course, there's a knife in his car, and we see
in the tire.
And yeah, we see. I'm trying to think of what that. So this guy is also real, and it's interesting. Dan Graney says that the only violence that occurs in this movie are the people who committed violence in real life.
Mm-hmm.
So this guy murdered a stuntman on the ranch, like in real life. So when this is the scene where I was like, well, okay, that's the end of Brad Pitt. But he ends up, he's like, he goes out, he's like, "This isn't even my car." He pulls out the jacket on the tire. He's like, "Fix it."
This was another great
yeah.
scene.
Yeah. And he's like, "No, I'm not fixing it." He jumps down. He's like, and fine. Brad Pitt doesn't miss a beat, kicks the guy right in the nuts and punches him in the mouth. And then, you know,
and all the girls on the side, "Oh, yeah. We
and
love you."
He just grabs him by his hair and it's just like hockey punching him.
Yeah. Yeah.
And finally he's like, "You make one more move, I'm going to knock his teeth down his throat." And he's like, "Fix it."
Yeah.
And he fixes the tire. And then at this point, Tex is flying back and Brad Pitt's yeah. already gone.
They were like, I guess they were making money by taking families on tours on
yes.
horses around
yeah.
the ranch.
Yeah.
And so he was given one of those tours and girl goes, gets him. He comes back.
And he's already gone.
But Tex is like one of the tough guys. Like there's all these women and there's a couple guys. And so Tex
was
Manson
kind
of
that on purpose. Yeah. He kept the men to a low number yeah. because, you know.
So Tex was kind of the muscle. If someone, you know, if
Tex,
they needed help.
I think he's still in jail. I think the two girls are out.
Really?
Yes.
They got out?
Yes.
Huh.
I'm almost positive that the two of them are in Texas, still in jail. But
this was so intense because not only with all this stuff, like, you know, you think he's dead and there's all these times where they're going to get him or do whatever. And then Tex comes, you're like, "Oh, crap, what's this show now going to be?"
Right.
Like? And he just barely misses him. The guy had fixed the tire and Cliff
was
driving
gone.
Off right as Tex comes in.
Right.
So
yeah. So we flash forward about 6 months. We find out that Rick has taken the deal to go to Italy. And do the Western.
A lot's happened in 6 months.
Yeah. I do like that. It's interesting. Like, does DiCaprio have something else coming out after this? Because he was jacked. I thought he put on like some serious muscle towards the end of this movie. And I'm just wondering if he was bulking up for something else later. Because maybe it's just the style of clothes that he was wearing.
I mean, DiCaprio doesn't do a lot of stuff. And like, again, this is his first movie in 5 years.
Yeah.
I don't think he has anything.
I don't know. He looked in pretty ridiculous shape in that last scene. So we just, you know, the movies are kind of, you know, drying up. He did
like three movies.
Yeah,
right?
He did four westerns out there. One with Telly Savalas,
yeah.
as a matter of fact.
Made a bunch of money. Got
of
himself an Italian wife.
Yeah, right. And they're flying back. But in the process, he realizes this is kind of the end of the road for Cliff and Rick. So
he's got a wife to take care of.
They're
going to
go tie one on one last time and have one good night. Out together at the same time. Now this is the night of the Tate LaBianca murders,
and they set it up like a true crime documentary with the timestamps and the locations
and you've got
the people.
Kurt Russell's doing the voiceover about actual things.
I don't like the
happening.
Voiceover, like, I think they should have either had a narrator or not had a narrator. I didn't like the 2 hour gap between the appearance of the narrator.
Like in the third
when,
act.
When it came back in, it was a little bit.
He's got like one little narration at the beginning.
He talks about the car accident.
And then you never hear from him again until the very end.
Right.
And
I liked it, but I agree it was jarring because when you didn't have a narrator for so long, you forgot there was a narrator.
And it feels lazy.
It
like,
made me wonder if that was to make up for scenes Tarantino cut.
I think the 4 hour cut did not have a narrator. And when he cut it to three, he decided to just explain it a little further. But this movie is one that I was praising it because it doesn't spoon feed you things.
Mm-hmm.
And this movie is one that shows you all that you need to know. And so by having a narrator, it takes away from that. But again, I think that in that longer cut, we're going to see all that extra stuff. I think Kurt Russell's great as the narrator.
Russell's always great.
It's Kurt Russell,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
so what are you going to...
Yeah.
And Tex Watson is still
Tex,
in jail.
Yeah, okay. But the other girls are out, right? It was Sadie May and... Katie, I think, was the other one. So they get back to the house. And so the Tates and kind of go out with their little crew to this Mexican restaurant, and DiCaprio and
Brad all this
Pitt.
Was really happened.
Yes, they actually went out that night. Yeah. It was all real. It was the hottest night of the year. They came home and everybody was kind of just mucking around in the Tate house.
And by doing the timestamps and everything, Tarantino made another brilliant move by, you're like, we know what's going to happen. And now he's showing us real dates and times and weather and stuff. So like, right. He's setting up for what we all know will happen.
We know what's coming.
So that misdirection, I think, was another great move to where you couldn't even possibly expect it would be changing. He's giving you all the information. Like, here's how it happened.
Right. So Brad Pitt kind of takes his dog for a walk and smokes an acid dip cigarette that he bought. Like,
he stashed there.
DiCaprio.
Chekhov's acid dip cigarette.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. DiCaprio's kind of making himself some frozen margaritas. Margaritas are a big part of this movie. There's a lot of margaritas going on. And now we've got the car pulling up to the house. And of course, DiCaprio kind of comes out and he was like, what the? I pay all this money in taxes and I got this hunk of junk. And he goes out there and just starts. And I was like, okay. I go, okay, well, we're losing DiCaprio.
This was, like, yeah, totally.
I thought that's it.
No question that they were going to pull out a gun and shoot him right there in the street.
Well, they actually, I mean, that gun.
Yeah,
is
and
the,
I thought that's how they were going to end up not murdering the Manson family, is that they were going to kill
him instead.
They were going to shoot him in the street, and that was going to be the.
Got it.
The
nope.
Yeah.
They immediately are just like, sorry. Like, we'll get out of here. He's like, God damn hippies.
And then what they're like, I think that was the guy from.
Yeah. Rick, yeah. There was the other. He's like, was that Rick Dalton from Bounty Law?
Yeah.
He's like, did I just get yelled at by.
Yeah.
There was one member of the family it's not how they got caught, but she was like a key witness. And I think it was that girl.
Yeah, the one that drives away didn't really do that, but she's the one that turned on them.
Yes, right. Brad Pitt comes back. He kind of gives the dog his food. I do like the dog. Is like, I love that dog. Like
the
that,
dog's great.
The dog,
Brandy,
was
her
and
name.
And the rat flavor.
Oh, so fun.
Dog
like, yeah,
food.
So gross.
He made that brand up. He made
Wolf's Tooth.
Yeah, Wolf's Tooth is another made up brand. There's a beer that Brad Pitt drinks that's a made up. You know, Tarantino verse brand. And then the cigarettes are
Red Apple
and from other stuff.
That's from Pulp Fiction, I think.
Yes. There's a lot. That's that a brand. Fiction, yeah.
I love that gag at the end of the movie with the Red Apple commercial. Yeah. The dog kind of perks. So there's a running gag where the dog, like Brad Pitt, tells the dog not to whine, otherwise he's not going to eat. And the
dog's clearly very well trained.
Yes.
And he sets up the scene by putting the dog on the couch and telling it not to move.
Don't move.
Until he tells it to.
Probably at some point a stunt dog.
Yeah.
Probably. I don't even think it was a stunt dog. I think it was just a foam head.
So we have Chekhov's dog.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
So the dog hears something moving in the background. Brad Pitt reacts. All of a sudden, here comes the Manson family. And they break into the house. And at this point, I was like, what now? Like, this is the point where I was like, I have no idea what's going to happen. I have no clue.
And when you say the house, you mean Rick's house.
I mean Rick's house, not the
where
Tate house.
Sebring and Tate are.
Yes, not the. So, and then I do like where he's just like, I thought there were supposed to be more people here. And they're just like, no, it's just him and the girl in the back. He's like, well, get her. So finally, Brad Pitt is tripping balls. And he's like, Are you really not even sure they're real? Are you really here? And he was just like, "What? You know, I'm here. I'm the devil." And that's a line. That's a real line. Like, I'm the devil. I'm going to do the devil's
work.
I'm
here to do the devil's.
So yeah. So Tex says that to Brad Pitt, and
starts laughing.
And the callback when the medics come is hilarious.
Oh,
I
like,
laughed out loud.
The devil.
He said he was here. He was the devil, and is here to do some devil's. I busted out laughing the way he described
it. This is the Tarantino violence. Immediately.
Which was amazing.
Yeah.
It was so cartoonish and unexpected, and I was laughing. I was oohing and aahing with the audience.
It was gnarly.
Again, a movie has not surprised me and made me feel like this in a long time, where I was engaged with it, surprised by it, shocked by it.
Right.
It just, to expect this, I don't.
That's much like the Hitler thing. They turn this story on its head.
Yeah.
So Brad Pitt basically takes out the Manson family by himself. Him and the dog take everybody out. Well, I'll get to that part. So he destroys.
And in the most violent way possible, because these are not good people. These are murderers.
Yes.
And to get justice, not only by giving Sharon Tate her spotlight and showing her and
they,
Margot Robbie.
So they gut her. They cut that baby out of her stomach in real life. Like, that's a real thing. I think somebody heard something where she said, please don't kill my baby. And they were just like, nope. And just went, I mean,
But this was Tarantino. You know, a lot of his movies, most of his movies are revenge movies. And this was Tarantino's revenge.
On the Manson family.
You know, yeah. And I just, you obviously have no sympathy for these people. And it was fantastic to see them, you know, even if this is just a fairy tale, it was a nice.
I want the 16, the 13 Fists of McCluskey.
14.
14. Yeah. I want that to be a movie, like in real
life. Wants the prequel.
Yeah. Because
the 14th Fist, that was just
a little much.
Yeah. Yeah. The franchise really kind of lost steam on that one.
So, it's obvious why they didn't make the 15th.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So he stomps Tex into oblivion. He grabs one of the other girls, the ginger one, and just destroys her face. And then
He throws the can of dog food straight into her face.
That was the brunette. Oh, he's like, yeah, I remember you. You pasty. Yeah.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. He's just like
railing on. Like,
he smashes her head into a phone and the wall.
Curbs stomping her on the mantle,
yes,
basically.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then the other one falls out the window. And I do love DiCaprio's reaction because he's got headphones on, so he doesn't hear any of it. All of a sudden, this girl falls into bloodied up and she's disgusting and she's screaming. And he's like, I got an idea. And he goes inside and he has the flamethrower. From the 14 Fists of McCluskey and burns her alive.
Chekhov's
flamethrower.
The fact that he went and got a flamethrower and just lit her up. I mean, it was amazing. This whole showdown.
Now listen to this. I heard somebody on the way out of the screening saying, well, that wouldn't kill her because she could just jump and dive under the water. And I thought, yeah, and every time she comes back up.
That flamethrower again. So then they...
Only in a Bond movie can you escape fire on the surface by swimming 8 miles on one breath.
On one breath, yeah, exactly. The cops show up and they, you know, everything gets squared away.
I'm so glad Cliff wasn't dead too, because he was stabbed in his side, and so you're worried that, you know, but he's like, I'm all right.
Yeah.
He's like, go check on your new wife, because Rick wants to go to the hospital
with
him. He's like,
nah, I'm fine.
You'll see you tomorrow.
Yeah, so J. Sebring comes to the gate. And he's like, what happened? And DiCaprio kind of lays out what happened. He's like, do you want to... Sharon Tate comes on like the squawk box and kind of gives him... She's like, are you okay? He's like, yeah. Thank you for asking. Like, yeah, I'm okay. And so earlier in the beginning of the movie, he's like, I'm one party away. I'm one pool party away from being in the next Polanski picture. Yeah. And now here we are. Like, he gets invited up. Everybody in that house survives. The Manson family is murdered. Well, not murdered, but killed.
Yeah.
And that's kind of how it ends.
And it says, once upon a time.
As soon as
you realize
that
it was
a
fairy tale.
Oh, you son of a bitch.
And,
like, that's
it was
so
a beautiful
good.
Fairy tale. There was justice for the real-life terrible murders. Sharon Tate is alive. And
they don't talk about the LaBiancas, who are also murdered
that
night.
Well, I'm guessing that it all fell apart.
So the LaBiancas are murdered after the Tate House.
So, and then also now Rick Dalton has a chance to revitalize his career, because now he's in with Roman Polanski and Sharon Tate. So
he gets his happy ending.
It's a really nice, you know. Yeah.
There's one part of this movie you guys didn't mention at all that I have to mention.
Please. Yeah.
Boss Radio 93 KHJ, which has the same role in this that Wolfman Jack had in American Graffiti. Although he appeared in that movie, for most of it, he's just the guy on the radio everybody listens to. And in 1969 Los Angeles, Bill Drake was a consultant who started a new format and put it on 93 KHJ, which was the most popular AM music station in Los Angeles. FM hadn't really taken over yet.
It's the radio station that you actually hear their jingle in the Everclear song, AM Radio.
Oh, really?
It starts off, they use the same jingle in this movie, but it's just KHJ, Los Angeles. Like, yeah.
Interesting.
And it kicks off AM radio.
And here's the fascinating thing to me. When I was watching the movie, I recognized the morning guy, Robert W. Morgan, who used to say, good morning, everybody.
Yeah.
And the afternoon.
Is that where we get that from?
Yes.
Like making fun of the DJ, like what they used to call them, pukers.
Yeah.
That were like, good morning, everybody.
That was all the 60s top 40 guys.
Sure, yeah. That was
the afternoon guy was the real Don Steele. People would call up and say, is this the real? They called him that. The evening guy was Humble Harv. You hear those actual guys in this movie.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
Tarantino went back and listened to 17 hours of air checks that he got from air check collectors around the country. He put out requests for people to send him 93 KHJ audio.
That's good stuff.
And he took that and added it in, and where they were talking up a song in the air check, he then used that song in the movie.
That's pretty awesome.
The soundtrack to this was the soundtrack is literally driven by a radio station from 50 years ago.
That's what I'm talking about. His ability to integrate music into his flicks. And I mean, that's on another level, because then you have to like play off of what they actually said and go from there. Like, yeah, that's pretty impressive.
And you hear that radio station everywhere, because everybody who's driving in a car, which Tom hated, but you get, I was fascinated by it, because not only did I have the scenery, but also the sound of 93 KHJ. But I'm a radio freak, so that was your jam.
Because to us, it just added to the authenticity.
Yeah, it's another character in the movie.
Yeah, it was 1969 Hollywood. It looked like it. It sounded like it. Nothing about this movie, except for when they were filming on sets, made me go, that's a set. You know what I mean? When you looked at this movie,
except for the ones that were sets, right?
Right. It felt so real. And then all those little details for the diehards and people to look up and research, there's so much to unpack.
I'm so pissed that he was not Stuntman Bob.
Yeah.
I really wish you'd been Stuntman Bob.
I never give credit to a production designer on a movie, but there's a woman named Barbara Ling who's worked with Tarantino on other things. She and her crew are the ones who listened to Tarantino tell them stories about what was on Sunset Boulevard, and then they recreated it perfectly.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, it's a great looking movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So then there's like a quick little post credit sequence of him doing a red apple Rick doing a red apple cigarette commercial. And of course, you hear Tarantino say "cut," and he was like, "Oh my god, these are terrible!" And who picked this stand?
Oh, it's Tarantino.
I
was wondering if he had. I didn't see him in this.
It's
movie.
Absolutely
okay.
Him, yeah. He was like, "Who picked this picture for this? Look at the double chin. This is and smashes the thing, and that's how it ends." But yeah, I think this is. I need to go back and like Jackie Brown to me is the one that I never liked.
Oh,
but
it's
I think that
is.
I was.
It's the only one that he adapted.
I just watched it again recently.
I need to go back and rewatch that one. But I struggle with that one.
I think because it was a very different style
from
what came before it, and it didn't have like
a zip.
Yeah, it didn't have that same kind of punch.
It's a great movie, but everyone was expecting Tarantino.
Right. Yes.
And so when he delivers Jackie Brown, which is excellent, you're like, oh, well, it's not really Tarantino.
Right.
That doesn't mean it's bad, but you're just expecting, you know.
Right.
By the way, what he did in that movie for Pam Grier and Robert Forster, what he had done for Travolta with Pulp Fiction, which is revive a career that had been dormant for a long time.
Yeah. For sure. But yeah, so this is probably top four for me.
This is amazing.
I love this movie.
I would only because of lack of time, I would love to see this again. I just didn't get to.
I'm
going to
wait for that 4-hour cut.
Me too.
Yeah,
I would be interested to see if I like that better, because I felt like a lot of times this was just kind of meandering.
Sure.
But again, there were things I really liked about the movie.
Yeah.
I didn't like the ending at all. Like
Did you want them to do the whole murders?
I don't know what I wanted.
Sure.
You know, but I felt like because I felt like, I know this is going to sound weird, I felt like how they got killed was literally overkill. And
you mean the Manson family?
Yeah. And I felt like because we know what they do in real life, it kind of gave him
carte blanche.
Yeah. And permission to be.
Destroy them.
To be hyper violent with them in a way that was kind of played for laughs, that just. Even though they're awful people and I have zero sympathy for them, still didn't sit well with me.
I get that. There was definitely, I mean, when he starts going to town,
there
was definitely some audible like, ooh.
And it just felt kind of like, I don't know, juvenile to me. I didn't like it.
There's been some backlash about violence against women. And he had that problem in The Hateful Eight where he beat the shite out of Jennifer Jason Leigh.
These are murderers that.
Right.
Jennifer Jason Leigh's the bad, like, she's the bad gal in that movie, too. Like,
and
she's
I,
one of the worst.
But I feel like that's kind of the cover, right? That's kind of like, well, then if you're coming after me for violence against women, well, then then you're defending these murderers.
Right.
Like, that's the kind of like smug, kind
absolutely
of douchey jujitsu that's being played.
But here's the problem here. There really isn't that much outrage. We live in a culture where one person gets offended. We talked about
There's been a lot of articles about the Bruce Lee thing.
Yeah.
I've seen more articles about the Bruce Lee thing than the woman thing, although I've seen it.
Right, but anyone can write an article. What I mean is that there really isn't like a backlash or outrage, people picketing this movie. Like, now one person says something on the internet and gets outraged, and then someone else picks it up, and these are like non-stories that are becoming clickbait articles. You know what I mean? This really hasn't caused a huge controversy.
Right.
Everyone gets upset about
it. I know I was kind of squicked out watching it. It just kind of felt, it just felt, and I mean this in a non-sexual sense, but it just felt kind of masturbatory.
I get it.
Like it, that it was just kind of like, you know, I don't know. It was like watching a little kid play. play. Like, and then I do this, and I do this other thing.
The dog tears his arm off.
Yeah, and I was just like, and I just, it just did not sit well with me.
I can appreciate that.
You're not outraged and didn't write an article about it.
No, I just mean the work.
But yeah, I mean,
I
but that's
on a podcast.
But you're also a sensible person. You can not like something and not be outraged.
Right,
and, that's what I mean. Like, I'm sure some people didn't enjoy it, but my point is there isn't a backlash over this.
Everyone is saying, no, three people are saying, and you're repeating it.
Exactly. So
louder. That's the problem. But yeah, I think if you haven't seen this, well, we're too late now. But I don't know if number 10, like he's saying he's done at 10. And I don't know if 10 is the Star Trek movie or if he has something else original.
I'll believe the Star Trek thing when I see it.
Yeah, I agree.
Well, I also wonder when he says 10, if like his end run will be like, well, I'll just make things for Netflix. Those aren't really movies.
Yeah,
like,
maybe.
You know what I mean?
That I think he'll keep making them as long as he has a story he wants to tell. I think it's silly to put a number on it.
I want to kill Beatrice.
I also see him being like tongue in cheek and being like, you know, the 11th movie in the 10 film series of Tintin. Kind of like, you know, Hitchhiker's Guide with So Long and Thanks for All the Fish.
Thanks for All the Fish was like
the fourth book in the trilogy.
Right.
Yeah, like
right.
I could see him doing something like that. So
he loves movies. He's never going to stop if there's a story to tell. That's silly to put a number on it. You know what I mean? Like he's not like, I have this great story, but I already hit 10. No, just
oh, well.
Just
10A.
Yeah, right. 10.1.
So
there you go.
I guess that's it for this one. Let's go around the table and everyone can say where to find them.
This is Paul. You can find me on harrisonline.com and the Kevin Brackett designed harrischallenge.com for your daily trivia.
But go there anyway.
This is Joey. You can also follow me on the Twitter at Joey Butts, BUTTS21.
This is Kevin. You can see my work on the Kevin Brackett designed Harris Challenge trivia and also follow me on Twitter at Kevin R. Brackett.
And this is Tom. You can follow my work on the Kevin Brackett designed Twitter. At Roger Kubert or on Facebook at facebook.com/Tom O'Keefe. And if you you want to chime in on your thoughts on Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, please do so at facebook.com/Real Spoilers. Join the group. We'd love to hear your thoughts.
Don't be afraid to tell Tom he's wrong.
Yeah,
I mean, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, you'll be wrong, but that's okay. And then you can also find us on Patreon at patreon.com/Real Spoilers. So I don't know what we're doing next week. We've got a couple
scary
choices.
Stories to Tell in the Dark.
Or Blinded by the Light is also coming out.
Oh,
The Bruce Springsteen one. So we will have to have a huddle and decide that. So that's it for this one. Thanks for tuning in. And until next time, the briefcase is entirely full of...
Will you duck this need to know what I'm all about? There's something that you dig you can't figure out. Well, now you wanna know what moves my soul and what tips inside of my brain.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up Quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's Quince.com/upgrade.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.